Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Did you know if your guitar, bass, pedals, or any of your music gear is damaged, broken, or stolen outside your home, your homeowner's insurance policy will not provide coverage for any of it? That's right. Homeowner's insurance only pays if something happens inside your home and if the items are not used for business purposes. But Music Pro Insurance insures all your music gear, no matter where it is, anywhere in the world, even when you check it in as baggage on an airline. Here, let me give you some actual examples of coverage they've provided. You're in a car accident and your equipment is damaged, boom, you're covered. Your kid pours apple juice into your amplifier, covered. Someone accidentally spills beer all over your pedal board at a gig, covered. In fact, any kind of theft or accidental damage is covered, even water damage from hurricane and breakage from earthquakes. But here's what makes Music Pro really different. They're not going to argue with you over the value of your instrument or make you run around looking for receipts when it comes to paying your claim. They know exactly why your vintage instrument is worth 10 times more than a new one. Plus, all claims are typically paid and fully settled in 24 to 48 hours. So if your equipment is not insured properly, go to EveryoneLovesGuitar.com/Music Pro. Hit standard and then enter your information and get a free gear protection estimate. Don't be that musician who ignores this and then next month when something happens, you're wondering why you didn't take 10 minutes to do this properly. Make sure you go to EveryoneLovesGuitar.com/Music Pro, enter your information and get a free gear protection estimate. This way, when something happens, you won't lose a minute of sleep because you took care of this already. I want to talk to you about the Bose S1, which is an amazing speaker for acoustic guitars that I've been playing lately. The S1 has two separate channels. It has one for your guitar and then another one for a microphone. And then there's a third channel you can use for a looper or for backing tracks that you could access by Bluetooth or through a 1/8 inch plug. And the S1s are also very easy to carry. It's got an easy to grab top handle and absolutely anyone can tote it around. And it's also rechargeable for up to 11 hours. The S1 was specifically designed to optimize the sound of your acoustic guitar on acoustic guitar gigs. The guitar and mic channels each have separate tone, volume, and reverb controls, and there's also a proprietary tone match switch, which restores and optimizes the natural sound of your acoustic guitar, which, as you know, is typically the biggest problem with acoustic amps. Now, I tested the S1 myself, and the tone, volume, and reverb controls sound great, and they're very responsive. You can position the S1 in four different ways. You can tilt it back so you broadcast out to an audience, or you could put it horizontally, vertically, or on a stand. And the cool thing is the S1 has a Bose accelerometer, so it automatically adjusts the EQ and optimizes the sound for whichever one of these four positions you're using. The S1 also happens to be the best Bluetooth speaker that Bose makes, which is pretty compelling since Bose is known for the quality of their Bluetooth speakers. So effectively, you have an acoustic guitar amp, a PA, and a killer Bluetooth speaker all in one. And the bottom line is this. If you're an acoustic guitar player, there's absolutely nothing out there that sounds this good and this big that's also easy to carry and battery powered. As far as the Bluetooth speaker goes, I've used it many times here at home for family barbecues, and the sound is so good, my kids wind up arguing over who gets to play the music they want. You know, it's literally like having a full stereo system out on your patio. You can use the S1 for DJing, tailgating, or whatever you want. Before this, you'd have to spend a bunch of money on loads of different speakers and pedals to get the same thing the S1 does on its own. On top of that, it looks great, just like all Bose devices do. And besides whatever money back guarantee you get from wherever you buy the S1, Bose also warranties the S1 for 2 years for any kind of defects in materials or performance. For more information and to find out where to get your own S1, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/S1. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/S1. Get the S1. It's outstanding. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's A-N-N-E at westfloridarealestate.com. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. We got a really cool guitar player today, very unique in what he does, and he's the top of the line at what he does. We're with Jim Chemo West, who's not only been playing with Weird Al Yankovic for 30 years, which in itself is like a weird, but he's one of the top Hawaiian slack key guitarists and composers. He won a Grammy for his recent record, and we're going to learn about this music. It's beautiful. I listened to the whole record, and as we were talking before the call, man, it's almost like the music, as Jim said, it describes the it feels like the island. If you've ever been to Hawaii, it's beautiful. And anyway, we'll get into this. A couple of quick announcements. Number one is that don't forget, you could now watch these on YouTube, on our YouTube channel, or you could listen to them in podcasts, wherever you normally listen to the audio. And the second is I'm really trying to get a hold of Tony Iommi, Jimmy Page, Carlos Santana, Mick Taylor, or Joe Walsh. Love to have those guys on my show. So if you can connect me with them, please hit me up and let me know. I'd love that opportunity. All righty, Jim Chemo West. Jim's best known as a longtime guitarist for Weird Al Yankovic. As I said, he's been with Weird Al for 30 years. That's longer than most marriages, Jim. It really is, man. He's also regarded as one of the world's foremost kiho'alu, or Hawaiian slack key guitar artists. Did I get that right?
Kiho'alu, yeah. It means loose and key, yeah.
Yeah, there you go, man. And his music has garnered millions of streams on Spotify and Pandora. He's also a 2019 Grammy nominee for his recent CD, which is called Moku Maluhia Peaceful Island. He's also a 2008 winner of the Hawaii Music Awards and a three-time Nahoku Hanohano. Man, I'm rocking here, which is the Hawaiian Grammy. He's a nominee for there as well. He's also a two-time winner of the LA Treasures Award for his efforts in keeping this important acoustic guitar tradition, meaning Hawaiian slack key, alive, which is really popular over on the West Coast. For his work with Weird Al, he's earned 4 Grammys and a Billboard number one CD debut for 2015's Mandatory Fun. He's a veteran of Hawaii's slack key festivals, as well as the Southern California slack key festival. He's participated in these events every year from 2008 to 2018. He shared the stage with almost every top slack key player in the world at one time or another. He's got 12 solo CDs, and they feature many original compositions as well as arrangements of classic slack key tunes. His 7th CD, Guitar Stories, goes beyond slack key, and he explores other genres like West African guitar, which is great music if you never checked it out, Middle Eastern music, which is also really cool, and Americana. Slackers in Paradise features duets with slack and steel guitar legend Ken Emerson. And again, his latest CD, Moku Maluhia, Peaceful Island, is a mix of you got to say that word.
Nahe nahe.
nahe nahe, or very relaxing composition. It is, man. It was like, you know, I was laying there and I said, I need a palm tree and a joint. And that's it. Chemo's also worked as a composer for film and TV. And for many years, he's had a studio in LA. He's composed music for feature films, network TV shows, specials, and cable shows. And his slack key compositions have been used in a number of features, TV spots, cable, web, and documentaries. Jim, thanks so much for your time, and I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Mahalo. Thanks for having me on, Craig.
Mahalo, man. That's, you know, I got married in Hawaii, man. I've loved it there. I loved it. And I'm still married with the same woman, which is cool. It was so cool, man. The people were such, and you know, I read stuff about, well, you know, they're funny with the Haoles, which is, you know, which is the white people. I didn't feel that at all, man.
No, I've never felt that. You know, people, that's the spirit of aloha. You know, people in Hawaii are are proud to, you know, they're very accepting of anybody, you know, and, you know, I've never experienced anything like, you know, anything negative really the whole time I've been there.
And there's so many cultures, you know, island, Asian Pacific and cultures there as it is. It's a real melting pot, you know.
It is a melting pot, and that comes because of the old days of the sugar plantations. They would import the labor from different parts of the world, from Japan, from China, the Philippines, or Portugal, other parts of the Pacific. So Hawaii has always been this melting pot, and it's really kind of lovely because, you know, everybody just gets along in Hawaii. It just seems like, you know, there's no real racial issues there. I mean, people just seem to get along. Everything seems, it's very nice. Nice example for the world, really.
Man, it is a nice. And the other thing was, I remember when I go to a place, I don't go to like the Fifi restaurant. I don't go to Fifi restaurants anyway, but we go to like the local, like I want to eat fish and rice where the locals are eating it, you know, because then I can talk to people and it was really cool, man. I really dug that all over. So,
that's great. What island were you on?
We got married on Maui. We also spent time in the Big Island, which was really weird because they had, you know, all the mountains and then there was donkeys. This is a long time. This is, you know, almost 30 years ago. There was donkeys walking all like some countries have dogs. There was donkeys on the side of the road. It was really cute. And then we also went to, what's the big tourist trap?
Well, Waikiki probably. Yeah.
Right. We went there for a couple of days too, you know, which I didn't like. I like that the least, to be honest with you.
It's okay for a couple of days.
Right. That's about it. And then you have your fill, then you go to enjoy Hawaii. So, in fact, we're going to go back. Actually, we're just talking about it.
Nice. Nice. Yeah,
I'm looking forward to that.
Well, so for Kauai is a nice place, island to go to. Kauai is beautiful.
Yeah. We went there. We stayed at the, it's not there anymore. It was on the, man, I'm having such a brain. This is so many years ago, but we went to Kauai. That was really beautiful.
Was it the coconut palms or one of those famous ones? Or
no, but I know the coconut palms because I was on their mailing list and they'd rehabbed it after the hurricane.
Yeah, yeah.
No, this was, I can't think of the name of it, but it was a gorgeous place. And I remember, you know, I was just a kid and it's funny what, you know, you haven't stayed at a lot of nice hotels at that point. And I remember it was so cool because it's funny. In the bathroom, it was like a glass door in the shower, but if you push the button or something, it was mirrored. It's like when you're a kid and you go to the, they used to have the quarter vibrating beds. It's like, whoa, that's really, you know, it's a beautiful hotel. And it was just a great time, man. You know, good place to get married. Hey, for people that don't know, for listeners that don't know, explain what Hawaiian slack key guitar is and how'd you get into playing it?
Well, slack key is, you know, basically, like I said, the word Hawaiian word for is ki ho'alo, which means loosen the key. And essentially, it's an open tuning. And in Hawaii, there are many, many tunings that people use. A lot of them were associated with different families.
That's interesting.
And there's a whole backstory to it. I'll just try and say it pretty quickly, but you know, in Hawaiian, before contact, which was not until the late 1700s, Captain Cook was the first European to discover Hawaii. You know, Hawaiians didn't have music as we know it. They had chants and things like that, and that's the kind of thing that they would use as basically their oral history, you know, to keep their, you know, history alive, because they didn't have a written language, you know. So eventually, after contact, one of the early explorers, George Vancouver, he brought the king, Kamehameha, a gift of 3 head of cattle, a bull and 2 cows, because they didn't have big animals like that in Hawaii. They had pigs, I think, were the biggest mammals they had, small pigs. But anyway, over the years, you know, these were the property of the king, and the herd expanded and expanded, and eventually they kind of became feral, you know, all over the island. Mm-hmm. And it caused a lot of problems. But the local, the regular people couldn't do anything about it because they belonged to the king, right? And they'd get in trouble if they, you know, killed any of them. So 30 or 40 years later, Kamehameha's descendant, Kamehameha III, had gone. Royalty was starting to travel. They would go to England and they would go to San Francisco on a sailing ship. And when he was there in the San Francisco area, which is actually owned by Mexico at the time, this was early 1800s. It was still part of Mexico, Spanish controlled. He saw these Spanish cowboys, vaqueros, and they were managing cattle. They had their ropes and their ponies. And he said, I've got to hire some of these guys and bring them back and teach my people how to do this. You know, so he contracted some of these vaqueros to come over to Hawaii, and they came over with their ponies and their saddles and their ropes. And they came over with guitars as well. And the Hawaiians had never heard a guitar before. And so they were just mesmerized by this sound, you know, and it was very generous. The vaqueros, when their contract was up, they left their guitars behind. And the Hawaiians really didn't have any idea of how to tune them. They just tuned them to whatever sounded good, you know. And so one guy would tune it one way, another guy would tune it another way. And it, since there weren't many instruments around, they kind of had to create their own orchestra with the one guitar, you know. So they, with the slack lower strings, they were able to kind of play bass lines and play melodies all at the same time, you know. So it's that's what sort of defines the style. But I got into it. I took my first trip to Hawaii in 1985. It was just a chance trip. A friend of mine invited me to go stay with him and another local family in Hawaii, in a little town called Hana Maui.
The road to Hana.
Yeah, Hana Maui. So I'd never been to Hawaii before, and I went right to Hana Maui, which is one of the most Hawaiian places in Hawaii. You know, there's like one gas station and, you know, two little stores and, you know, very tiny rural town. So anyway, when I was there, I you know, they had a lot of great music at Hawaiian Records at the house, vinyl at the time, and cassettes. And the stuff that I really fell in love with was these slack records by Gabby Painui and Sonny Chillingworth and Ray Kane and all these great, you know, slack key players. That's the stuff that I really loved, and I just loved the sound of it. So I didn't really, you know, sit down and try and play it, but I just kind of absorbed it over a number of years. I just enjoyed listening to it. And
so you kept going back, or you just absorbed it?
Yeah,
you just started
what
buying
happened
stuff
was
from
I
the
kept
mainland.
Going back and forth. I fell in love with Hawaii, and I you know, I'd be over there when I wasn't doing anything in LA, I'd be over there sometimes for a couple of months or something. And, you know, so I spent a lot of time in Hana, and eventually that style just sort of crept in to my playing. I had a really good friend of mine that came and visited me when I was staying in Hawaii. And he was a chef, actually, which is always nice to have a chef house guest. But after I got back to LA, I got this phone call that he had passed away, and he was only in his late 20s, and a young guy.
Oh my God.
And I was just kind of heartbroken. And you know, you pick up your guitar at times like that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it comforts you, you know. And for some reason, I just started playing this slack key song. I hadn't even studied the genre. I hadn't even sat down and go, I'm going to try and figure out this or anything. I just had it in open tuning, and all of a sudden this piece of music came out, and it was slack key. It just kind of came out of nowhere. And so I recorded it so that I had to send to his family, you know, and then I showed a few other people in Hawaii. I played it, and they were going, oh, this is really good. You should do more of this, you know, and that encouraged me to play more. And I eventually, like I said, I still wasn't really, you know, studying the genre. I more or less just wrote my own slack key tunes, and I would record them so that I wouldn't forget them. And eventually somebody said, hey, you've got 12 songs. Why don't you make a CD? And I had, you know, not even considered it at all. But you know, I had a friend who was an artist, and he put a cover together, and all of a sudden it was like, you know, the most amazing feeling. There it was, my first CD. I couldn't even believe it. You know, it was my, and then, you know, it just, it kind of took off. I got such a good feedback from it, and got invited just, you know, to play the festivals, and it just became a roller coaster. And I just went on and followed that path, you know.
Man, that's so, you know what I always find amazing is there's, not always, but many times like this, there's the genesis of how something happened. Mm-hmm. Is so random, like your buddy died and you wrote this, you know, you were in mourning.
Yes.
And just picked up the instrument and expressed your feelings. And isn't that, I mean, that's like really weird, isn't it?
It
I mean,
is.
Weird
it
in a good way.
It came out of nowhere because I really hadn't been studying it. Yeah. I had listened to Slack Key for like for a number of years, and it just sort of, you know, I had absorbed it, you know, but I hadn't really sat down and seriously tried to, you know, play in that style. It was very, very strange.
Man, and here you are, 12 CDs and a Grammy nominated. I mean, it's like, it's crazy, isn't it?
It's bizarre how your life can, you know, can take such a right turn, you know, a radical turn out of nowhere. And if it's, in this case, it was something that was really just meant to be, I guess, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So when you play Slack Key, there's no special guitar. You just play a regular acoustic and tune it down?
Yeah, just regular acoustic. And even some of the old timers would play Slack Key on electric guitars, like Leonard Kwan. He would, his famous sound was like a sort of a hollow body electric through a Fender amp with the tremolo going.
That sounds pretty cool. What's his name? Leonard Kwan?
Yeah, Kwan. Yeah, Leonard Kwan. Yeah.
That sounds pretty cool, actually. I love hollow body.
That was his style. He was the electric Slack Key player, but
that's really cool.
Yeah.
Was there? I think we covered this already, but there was never any resistance to you as a Slack Key, as a Howley, not a native, was there?
You know, surprisingly not. I mean, when I played my first, I was invited to. Well, let me backtrack. When I put that first CD out, which was called Coconut Hat, I had a publicist, and she set up some, a record release party on Honolulu and one on Maui, and you know, and she invited everybody from the industry, and it was, everybody was so accepting, you know, and I was right away invited to play the Maui Slack Key Festival.
Man, how could that must have felt like $1 million?
Yeah, and it was all Hawaiian guys, you know, and here's this Howley guy up there, but all the Hawaiians were like, "Hey, brah, mahalo for keeping this going, you know, mahalo for doing this." It wasn't like, "Hey, what are you doing, a Howley trying to play Slack Key?" It was more like, "Hey, thank you for helping to keep this alive," you know. Everybody was, you know, completely with me. It was like, "Hey, you know," and I remember years later, Cyril Paginui, who recently passed away, he was the son of Gabby Paginui, great Slack Key player, and we were very good friends. And I remember being over at the Merry Monarch Festival on the Big Island, and we were talking. And I remember him, you know, he would joke around a lot, but sometimes he would be really serious. And, you know, and he's just, at one point, he was just, you know, "Kimo, you're one of us, bro." You know, and it was just like,
man, that's really freaking cool. Yeah, man, that's really cool. Well, I think, though, you know, because you read books and see documentaries, and it's the same thing like with the Blues Cats, you know, when you had Buddy Guy, Albert King, all these guys, and then they had Stevie Ray Vaughan and Clapton and guys coming in there like that. It was the same sense of, hey, man, thank you for keeping this alive.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's a very good parallel there. Yeah,
really cool.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, so now do you split your time between LA and Hawaii now, or?
Yeah, I've always been based in LA. I mean, for the last, you know, since the early 80s, but, you know, I love Hawaii so much, and, I go over there about 3 times a year, you know, I'll go over there for a couple weeks at a time, or maybe 3 weeks. I'm not living there half the time, but I go over and play shows, and sometimes I just go over for, you know, just to hang out.
You probably got tons of friends there, I would imagine.
Yeah, a lot of musician friends there. And, I have some nice gigs that I can play over there and some festivals. And
man, that's stuff. Great. That's really good. It's a nice little, not second life, but it's a nice little adjunct.
It is.
You know, it really enriches your life, this whole thing,
absolutely,
man.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'll move over there full time. But right now it's kind of difficult. Hawaii's tough because it's, first of all, it's expensive to live there. It's gotten much more expensive because, you know, a lot of wealthy people buy up real estate for second homes, and it's
China, Japan.
It pushes the market up, and it's also, you know, it's expensive to live there, but also there's not a lot of work for musicians there. You know, a lot of Hawaiian musicians will go to Japan. They'll go to the mainland and tour. You know, in Hawaii, most people expect to hear music for free in the hotel bar or whatever, you know, and there's not a lot of kind of nice gigs for musicians. They're mostly just background music gigs, you know, and you know, and they, the hotel managers would probably rather have Hawaiian guys than Hawley guys in their plans.
Well, yeah, because most of the people there are tourists, so they want to quote exactly, see the real thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, so it's expensive to live, and you know, it's hard to make a living economically to live there. But, you know, at some point when I, you know, don't need to make money so much, I'll move over there full time.
That's awesome, man. How did you get hooked up with Al Yankovic, and what were you doing before that musically?
Well, you know, I had just moved to LA. I grew up in Florida.
You grew up here in Tampa, right?
I did. Yeah. I grew up in Tampa. That's
where,
right.
Where in Tampa?
Well, it was over in near the Temple Terrace area.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Eventually my parents moved to after I was in LA, they moved to Lutz, where you are.
Yeah, man, that's where I am. Exactly. That's so funny.
Very close to you. So funny.
Where did they live in Lutz?
It was right off of Sunset Lane.
Oh yeah, man. That's right. I'm like on, you know where the Apex is?
Yeah.
I'm like really close to that, right off Chapman. It's like very close to where your folks live. That's funny, man.
I actually, before I moved to LA, I was living in a house on Hayes Road. There was a little lake there.
I know exactly where that Hayes Road is. It's a connection between Nebraska and Florida, man.
Yeah, I used to live right around there. Yeah.
That's quite funny.
Anyway, so I had moved to LA in the early 80s. I was playing at a big club in Tampa, and it was called Robocondi's. It was like a house gig, you know, and it was really prestigious gig. But I had a chance to move to LA and you know, sort of join a band that was already working, you know, and so it was a good opportunity. I knew I wanted to move somewhere, a bigger place, you know.
Like, yeah, there's no music epicenter, you know, here, man.
I needed to go somewhere, and this opportunity presented itself for me to go there and actually, you know, be working, you know, and support myself. But a couple years after I was in LA, my friend Steve, who plays bass with Weird Al, and we're longtime friends from Florida, he had moved out a little before me, and I think he got called to play on Al's first record when Al got his record deal. And
as a session guy?
Yeah, as a session player. And then he called me one day and said, hey, you know, this guy Al is he's got some gigs, and he wants to put a band together to play these gigs, and he needs a guitar player, and he's going to audition some guitar players. And, you know, I was playing in like three or four different bands. Got some gigs, you know.
Sorry, it broke up for a second. You said you were playing in three or four different bands?
Yeah, I'm just playing in different groups. I was in a sort of a punk band and a rockabilly band and various things. So
so you're doing some serious woodshedding.
Yeah. And anyway, so when this opportunity came up to play for Al, I mean, got a couple of his tunes, and actually learning the songs, I was thinking, oh, these are quite well constructed, you know, where they're lyrically really solid, you know. And so, you know, he called me one day, he goes, hey, you know, you got the gig, and okay. And so we, you know, started playing a few little shows. I mean, they were pretty nice gigs around town. And one of them was opening up for Missing Persons at the Civic Center, big Civic Center audience. They hated us. Of course, it's a
totally different crowd. Yeah, that was a
big mistake.
Yeah. who paired those? You know, that's weird.
I mean, we were like, you know, inundated with stuff being thrown at us from the audience, you know, just like trying to avoid all the various things they were throwing at us.
Yeah.
But anyway, soon after that, Al started working on his next record, and that's the one that really broke out. It had Eat It, you know, the Michael Jackson parody, and, you know, and MTV was just coming up then. So all of a sudden it was a big, you know, surge in popularity. And then all of a sudden we were, you know, touring and actually on real tour buses and, you know, I had lots of limo rides and that kind of stuff. So we, you know, and Al's career has had this sort of very long, gradual, you know, rise, you know, and then the last record, it's been a few years now, but the last record was actually a Billboard number one, you know, for a week, you know.
That's amazing, man.
It actually got to the top of the charts. So it's been another interesting turn that, you know, I would have never expected, you know. You know, here I am, you know, some guy with an accordion. Okay, sure, you know, sounds good, you know. And all of a sudden, there's another radical turn that you would have never expected that I just followed. And, you know, so I've had these sort of two unusual career paths. You know?
Yeah. Is most of the team been together that long, or is it just you, the bass player?
Oh, no, really? The drummer has actually been with Al the longest, and it's been a long time since the early 80s. You know, I mean, it's longer than most bands are ever together, you know.
And you tour and are on the records.
Yeah, I play on the records as well.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
That's a really fantastic gig. You know, you don't have, there's not a lot of gigs like that.
I do some production on the records as well, like, you know, anything that's got a lot of, like, MIDI sequencing, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm kind of the guy who does that probably the best. And so I tend to, Al often, you know, has me do some of that kind of work as well. You know,
that's awesome, man.
Yeah.
Tell me a couple of funny stories or interesting stories about your experience with Al over the years, stuff that's funny that might've happened or unusual.
Oh my God. You know, there have been so many, so many things, you know, in the studio, even, I mean, crazy stuff, you know. Like, I remember once we were doing this, I forget what the song was, but he wanted to try doing background vocals, these really high background vocals, because we were all, the bass player and I and Al were going to sing the background vocals. So he had, what he'd done is he brought in tanks of helium. And we sang all the background vocals on helium.
Oh my God. That's, you know, no one else is, you know, Deep Purple's not doing that, man. You know? Oh my God. That is pretty funny.
He was doing a tune about dental decay. It was a parody of a U2 song that, what was that song, U2, like Hold Me, Kiss Me, Something Thrill Me. I don't know. It was one of those.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was off the Achtung Baby album, I think.
Yeah, yes. And he changed it to something like, drill me, floss me, bill me. It was all about dental work, you know. So he actually, we're at the end on the vamp out where it's just sort of instrumental and there's a bunch of screaming and stuff. He basically had his dentist come in with an actual drill from his office and a human tooth, and they mic'd it up with a couple of mics, you know. Had a blasting through the monitors, you know, the sound of a dental drill drilling a tooth, and you know, and then of course he overdubs all kinds of screaming, you know, and like painful screaming. It was like the worst sound I've ever heard in my life. That sound of the dentist drill only coming through the monitors at like 110 dB. You know,
oh my God. What kind of crowds show up? Like, you know, I talked to like Steve Morse, and you know, when you talk to the more technical guys, they're like, there's no women at any of my shows. It's all it's all guitar players. And so yeah, or sometimes you know, it's baby boomers or it's young kids, but what's the crowd, the typical profile for?
Well, the crowd, the thing is, Al's been around for so long that the crowd is all ages.
Yeah.
So you've got fans who are now parents and they're bringing their kids and they're, you know, 6-7-year-old kids are standing on their seats. And they're entertained by the spectacle of it all. And of course, the thing that what's really facilitated that is that because Al is always commenting on, you know, what is current at the time.
Yeah, that's true.
Always constantly generating a new fan base. You know, because
I wonder if that was deliberate on his part.
No, I don't think it was. That's just smart. What he does. And he's I don't think he ever thought that through. But, you know, the 7- and 8-year-old kids that are screaming along and singing all the words, they're the ones who know the most recent stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know?
And of course, the parents remain, you know the old stuff and don't really know the new stuff. So you have this really huge range. I mean, the biggest demographic range of any concert, it's more like something you'd see at a, you know, sporting event or something. I mean, because it's just every age.
Families and it's
families. Yeah. And the show is family friendly. I mean, Al is pretty edgy, but he keeps it pretty clean. You know? So you can bring your kid. And the thing is, so many kids, so many people say that Weird Al was their first concert. That's because funny. Parents could bring them to Weird Al, have a good time, and it wasn't, they knew they weren't going to, you know, there wasn't going to be anything dicey in there for the kids. And in fact, you know, Jimmy Fallon is a huge fan of Al, and years ago when he was on SNL, you know, he opened up for us once in Poughkeepsie, New York. Doing his musical comedy with a guitar.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were talking to him backstage and he was going, yeah, Al was my first concert. His parents took him to see Al when he was a kid and he pulled out the ticket stub.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Isn't that crazy? So even so when we go on the Tonight Show to play to Jimmy Fallon, he's like, you know, oh my God. He's, you know, he's like such a,
like,
you know,
a fanboy on it.
Fan, yeah.
Has there ever been, I'm not looking for dirt or gossip or anything like that, but was there ever like a conventional like chick fan base of like, you know, they're like line, like, you know, the old days?
Yeah, you know, not really. You know, I mean, Al's demographic, even in the old days, it was still, you know, there in the early days, it was a lot of guys, but there were definitely girls too, you know, that liked Al. It was kind of like a kind of hip nerd crowd, you know?
Yes.
But, you know, certainly nothing like a Motley Crue thing, you know, and people, there was never really anything like that. It was kind of a nerd crowd, you know? So
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. It wasn't really, certainly wasn't the Motley Crue or anything.
Any takeaways or lessons for you having spent so much time and really achieving a good level of success in such like completely diverse arenas musically? Any takeaways for you in that?
Well, you know, I always tell people to, you know, that are want advice in music to, you know, spread yourself out and, you know, you can be really focused on something that you really want to do, but it's also a great idea to learn some of the other parts of the business, you know, maybe learn some recording engineering, learn some, you know, publicity, learn how to do a bunch of different things, because you never know what opportunity is going to present itself. You know, sometimes things just pop up. A great example is I used to do a lot of song demos in my studio back years ago for you know, songwriters.
Yeah.
And I would put demos together, and I had a really good knack for that. And I had a client, she would come in and do these songs, and she wrote these kind of cool, quirky pop songs. And at the time, for her income, she was doing like temp work, and then she was also like selling flowers in restaurants, you know, walking around selling flowers. And, you know, so she was just getting by. And one day she called me and said, "Hey, you know, I got this offer from this company. They want to hire me full time. You know, I've been doing temp work for them." And I said, "Well, what's the name of the company?" She said, "Oh, it's some ad agency named Shiat Day." And I, you know, I had been doing some music for commercials, and I said, "Well, you know, that's a really good company. You know, those, they're coming up, and that, you know, that might be good for your career." So anyway, she ended up taking the job, and, you know, 2.5 years, she's got an award for producing like the, you know, top commercial of the year. And
wow.
then she went on to head the whole division that did all the advertising for Apple.
Wow. And this is, she went from a flower girl. So that's,
yeah. And
that's
so she
really
went
cool.
from this, you know, one thing, and she took this abrupt turn, and it became this, you know, huge success, you know.
That's a really good point as far as learning how to do other things. Cause I have interviewed so many guys that had another skill set and it opened up many doors for them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, for me, I've worn a lot of hats over the years. And so I started learning how to do engineering a long time ago and recording. That's always play with tape recorders and stuff. So I've always done all my own engineering. And then I've done a lot for other people as well. And then, you know, you learn, then I became in the 90s, I started doing composing music for TV and film. And so between that, and session work, Al, you know, the production, the engineering, the composing, you know, those are all different hats, but sometimes, you know, the work would be, you know, I'd get a lot of work in the composing thing. And then sometimes I'd be doing the production thing. And
so absolutely.
I was able to kind of, you know, work more than if I was just focused on just being a session player, for example. That would be really tough, especially in LA where there's so many incredible players.
And yeah.
You know, there's only so much work and there's a...
Well, especially now, if you don't have other skill sets, you just can't make it. At least if you want to do music full time.
Yeah, you have to. I think it's just it's almost a requirement now to have multiple skill sets, you know.
Well, and then all these things that you did allowed you to fund initially because you weren't getting paid. There was no profit center in the Slacky stuff day one.
No, that was something I just did for the love of it. You know,
right.
I had no, you know, I mean, I was happy if I could make my money back from the manufacturing the CDs.
Absolutely.
I was like, you know, great. I mean,
right,
but
right.
I was just doing it for the love of it. Yeah.
Which is great, man.
Yeah.
How did you get the, what film stuff have you done that if there's any that people might recognize and how'd you get involved in that?
Well, in the 80s, I've always written music, always written, instrumental music. And at a certain point, probably in the late 80s, I was thinking, you know, I'd really like to pursue this composing thing. And I didn't really have any connections, but I did, at one point I had this, friend of mine who was an audio post-production engineer, had a company that did a lot of audio production for films. He told me about this opportunity that was, very unusual. It was, for 20th Century Fox, and I hadn't done any original music for media at all at this point. This was a brand new thing. So what happened was they were going to release some of these classic films from the Fox catalog into different – put them into different languages and primarily China. And I think they had 12 or 13 films. So what happened was a lot of these films were from the 40s, 50s, you know, early 60s, old films. So anytime they were going to dub in the new dialogue, you know, in the different language – the music, if they didn't have the actual individual files, stems of music and effects, anywhere anybody spoke, they would have to recreate the stems and the music.
Which they probably didn't have most of them because this wasn't a digital. You know, it wasn't like someone had files stored in archives.
I mean, they did store that stuff, but over the years it would get lost, and it's
the quality of it.
Just yeah. So what happened was. So he said, you know, there's going to be a few people doing a demo for this gig. So a couple other guys who were more established did demos, but they just sort of did their own, wrote their own music, you know? And what I did was I copied the actual score note for note, you know, using samplers and playing it all manually. And so my demo, when they loved it because when they crossfaded from the original score into the dialogue, they couldn't even tell any difference. It sounded like it was nothing, you know, had changed, you know.
Shit, so that's so cool.
And what that did for me was, besides, you know, making some money, it was like over a year worth of work.
That's great, man.
But it was, you know, since, you know, I'm completely self-taught, but I studied, that was my, basically, that was my education in orchestration, was learning, taking those scores apart note for note and recreating them. And they were great composers, you know. I mean, Alfred Newman, and tons of great, you know, famous composers. So I got to learn about orchestration, you know, and actually getting paid for it at the same time.
But, you know, there's a lot of gigs like that where you're kind of like on the job tuition and you're getting paid, which is, you know, really great fortune.
An amazing thing. And then, you know, and then that led to some other features I did, which were not very well known, but, you know, they made me a lot of money because they played on cable a lot. They were kind of like action adventure, martial kickboxers and, you know, that kind of stuff, you
sure.
know? But they were very popular internationally and stuff. And, you know, they were, you know, and then I got into doing some animation. I had a connection with another composer friend of mine who did a lot of animation. So I did shows like Iron Man and, you know, My Little Pony and all kinds of stuff.
Did you get to do Slack Key in any of that?
Not really, no. Yeah. No Slack Key in any of those things at all. Although I did play guitar on one of the Fox things. I think it was The Sun Also Rises. That was there was some Spanish guitar on there. I think I had to duplicate at some point.
That's really cool, man.
But I've done a lot, you know, tons of, you know, commercials and Honda commercials and ESPN. And I don't do much of that anymore because I don't really have the time for it. But I enjoy doing it. You know, it's a lot of fun. And
yeah. It's anything where you could, I don't know. I think most creative people in general appreciate change. Mm-hmm. You know, where you could perform your creativity, but not, you know, not in the same thing all the time. So I think it's a really, you know, a great opportunity when those things come.
I always enjoyed, you know, because you're working to picture. I always enjoyed, you know, playing back your final thing for the day. Let's say you've maybe written 3 or 4 minutes a day in a day. That's a lot,
sure.
You know, to have it for, especially for animation, because animation, it's changing every few seconds. You know, it's going to another place. You know. So very difficult, but you know, at the end of the day, when you play back, you know, cause you start off with a piece of film with just dialogue and, you know, and it's just all of a sudden the music makes it so much better. You know, it's like really satisfying to play it back at the end of the day and go, wow, that just kills it. You know,
that's awesome, man. Very cool.
Yeah.
Talk about, so you grew up here in Tampa. What was your childhood like growing up?
Well, it was, you know, I was born in Canada. So when we moved to Florida, I think I was 9. And
oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, my parents were like sick of the cold and, you know, and they had some friends who had moved to Tampa. And so they had a connection there. And it was just, you know, when you're 9 years old and, you know, your friends are go on vacation to Florida, but it's like, no, we're moving there, man.
Yeah, that's probably pretty cool.
And it was, you know, I mean, all of a sudden the first summer I was there, we're going to the beach and going down to all these different beaches and palm trees. And, you know, I mean, it was just like paradise, you know.
Yeah.
It was
incredible.
Although, you know, it was a culture shock because Florida is so different than, you know, for example, where I grew up, I was born in Toronto, but I spent most of my early years in Ottawa because my dad was in the military.
Oh,
and
wow.
Ottawa was the capital, you know. So anyway, I remember one interesting thing was like I'd only ever seen one black person in my life.
Wow.
And because it was the capital, this guy was obviously, he was a diplomat. He was in a, you know, like Armani suit driving a Mercedes, you know. So I just thought that all black people were like super sophisticated and rich.
That's interesting.
And so when I came to Florida, all of a sudden it's like the deep South. And it was like, wait, what's going on here? This is culture shock.
Yeah.
You know, culture shock, you know? And of course I had a hard time understanding people because everybody spoke with, you know, such a Southern accent in Florida.
Now it's not like that. There's not the Southern, it's, you know, only in the real rural towns as you get,
yeah,
some of that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, it was culture shock, but it was, you know, I loved it being in a, you know, sunny place. And, you know, so I had a good childhood. And when I started playing guitar, my older brother, I have a brother who's 10 years older than me. So he played a little guitar, just, you know, folk songs and that kind of stuff, you know, a little finger picking. So, you know, at a certain point I just found his guitar in the closet. I think I was probably 12. And I just started, this is like when the Beatles first came out. So of course everybody's sure. Picking up anything to play, you know, like, well, even if it's a broom, you know, you want to be the Beatles, you know? So, I mean, I found his guitar and I started noodling on it. And I think it had like 3 strings on it. So he saw that I was interested. So he went and got some strings and a book and, you know, and that was it. You know, once I got that, I was just like locked in the room, you know, this was a magical discovery. And I just, you know, I just played and played and played.
A lot of people, it's a very similar story to a lot of people, as you would imagine. Mm-hmm. Were you inherently shy? Like, so was locking yourself in the room really like not a problem, or you just, you were outgoing, but you just.
No, I was pretty shy. You know, I mean, I had friends in school, you know, but I wasn't certainly an outgoing person, even to this day, really. But I just fell in love with guitar. It was just a world, you know, it was such a world of discovery, you know, when you're learning. I mean, everything is new. It's every day it's discovery. You're discovering different things. And there was no YouTube or anything, but sometimes I'd see like Glenn Campbell on TV or something. And I'd be like, oh my God, what's he doing? And they'd, you know, cause every so often there'd be somebody like Glenn Campbell or, or Chet Atkins or somebody to be on TV, then they'd have a focus in on the guitar, you know, because they were a guitar player. So the cameras would go to their hands and it's like, oh my God, you know, you can see what he's doing, you know. Of course, nowadays on YouTube, it's like, you know.
Right.
It's everywhere. But for me in those days, I didn't know anybody who played guitar. I'm self-taught. I didn't even have any friends who play guitar. So those moments of seeing people on TV playing were so valuable. Like, oh my God, that's how he's doing that, you know.
Where'd you go to high school? What high school?
To King High School.
I don't even know where that. Yeah, I don't think that's around anymore.
Yeah, probably not. Yeah, but anyway, I did meet a friend in high school when I got to high school, another guitar player, and so we started playing, and you know, and we eventually played some little gigs, and I think I played my first gig when I was 16. I got paid for it. I remember I got $40, and that was a lot of money in those days.
Sure. Of course.
$40. And it was like, you know, I was starting to go to college and it was just like, I don't know, this music thing is pretty darn cool, you know? So I didn't last very long in college. I was an art major in college, you know, I went to USL, but I was like, by that point I was playing gigs and I was making money playing music, and it was just like, I don't know about this art thing. I think I like the music thing better.
Good for you, man. Was Skippers around back then?
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, that's funny. I think it had just started. I think it goes back into the 70s, that place. You know, I played a lot of local dives in sort of the university area and rock and roll bands and stuff. It was a blast. I had a great time, you know.
Was there any culture shock moving from Tampa to LA?
Not really. I mean, there were two things. First of all, the traffic was like nothing I'd ever seen in my life. You know,
yeah,
I used to rehearse with a band in Burbank and I was living out in Westlake Village. So it's a good hour drive each way. And I mean, sometimes I'd be driving at a rush hour. It was just scare the hell out of me. But, I do remember one of the big shocks was, I started playing with this band right away. I sort of joined them over the phone really, but, we were rehearsing in Burbank. And so sometimes, you know, we'd go out for a beer afterwards. Hey, and then the guys were going, hey, let's go down to this place and see these guys play. And this little club, you know, no cover charge, just go and have a beer. And then these guys were playing. It was like, this was probably the third night I was in LA. They took me down there to see this. And these guys, it was like, oh my God, it's like, I kept focusing on the drummer, and they were all like spectacular, kind of jazz fusion guys, right? And I was just like, my God, that drummer! It's like I was thinking they don't have musicians like this in Florida,
in Tampa.
And
who's the
drummer? And they go, oh, it's this guy named Vinny Colaiuta, and who's that bass? Neil Steubenhaus, and you know all these just heavy session cats, you know. And they were, you know, the guitar player was just filling in, and he just had charts up there, and he was just. It was just like insane. You know, these guys were, I was just like, man, they don't have players like this. That was a reality check. It's like, okay, yeah. I'm in LA, man. This is a lot heavier scene than I thought.
I've heard that same story for both LA and Tampa and New York, where guys move there and they're like, holy shit. You know, they actually, you know, question, man, should I be doing this? When you see
I know.
Like,
it makes you want to put down your instrument, you know, when you hear guys like that.
Well, that's a good story, man.
Yeah.
Kimo, any low points or dark periods that you've had to go through, and how'd you get through them?
Well, you know, I was never a drug addict or anything.
That's good.
I think probably, you know, it's like with a lot of people, a lot of times your lowest points are usually some based on a relationship thing. You know, I was in a relationship for many years, like 12 years. And, you know, as that was disintegrating, that was probably my lowest point. I mean, you know, it's just one of those times where you just, you know, it's horrible. But then again, things, you know, good things come out of it.
It's hard to see that when you're every dark period, it's like,
Hard to see it. But, you know, I remember I started, you know, just doing a lot of reading, and I discovered some really great books, and eventually kind of like got into this sort of Tibetan Buddhist, you know, philosophy that really opened, you know, it was one of those things that just, it led me to that, you know, led me to this thing, which, you know, became a real eye opener. And I just, you know, I certainly became a better person after that from just studying and reading, and it was you're more introspective, and I think, of course, I think a lot of great music came out of that period too.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's right. Do you still practice that the Buddha, the Tibetan?
Well, it's not really a practice. It's just really it's just an outlook on life. It's just a way of looking at things, and I find it, I'm not really a religious person anyway. I just find it, it's kind of like an interesting, it's what resonates with me the most when I read about different spiritual, paths. I think that's the one that resonates with me more than anything. But, but a lot of spiritual, they're like paths to kind of, I always say they're just different paths that lead to the same source. There's all different ways of looking at it, but it all kind of comes back to one thing, and
I agree with you on that.
And that just, to me, that, like I said, it was a dark, dark period, but at the same time, this something really kind of great came out of it, And like I said, a lot of music too,
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk about gear for a few minutes. What's your go-to guitar, and what other guitars would round out your top three? And if you have, if you want to put two lists, one for slack key, one for everything else, that's fine.
Yeah. I mean, with Weird Al, it's an electric gig. There's some acoustic in the show, but it's mostly an electric guitar gig. And, for years I've been using these Tom Anderson guitars.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And Tom is a great friend of mine, and he made my first guitar for me in 1993. And
that's a long relationship.
Yeah. And that's the one I still use almost exclusively, that one.
What is it, a Strat or a Les Paul?
It's a Strat style, what he calls a classic.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful guitar. It's, it's got a rosewood neck and a swamp ash body, and it's just a gorgeous, it plays like butter, and it just, I can get so many sounds out of that guitar. It's fantastic. And then I have another one that's more modern. It's the same thing, except that it's just more modern, and that's sort of my backup, in case something happens to that one. And then I've also got one of his Tellys. It's kind of a hot rodded Telly with a Strat pickup in the middle. So it's got three pickups, and then it's got a interesting switching thing where you can have like all three pickups, or you can have the two outside pickups, and then it's got a piezo in the bridge too. So you can blend that in.
Oh, that's interesting.
You could actually, with a one switch, it has a switch between the electric pickups and the piezo. So if you have it set with two outputs, you can be doing a verse and be strumming acoustic, and all of a sudden bang right into some power chords.
That's cool, man.
Through a different amp. It's a really versatile guitar. So I use that a lot. And those three Andersons are my main ones. And I have, specialty guitars. Like on this tour, I have a Dan Electro baritone, six string baritone that I use on one song. And I have a Les Paul I use, I just carry that just to have a couple tunes, just to have a,
man, you got to have a Les Paul with you.
Yeah. You got to have
you're a playing Les Paul. Rock. You're in a rock gig.
So anyway, but I have a lot of, off the wall guitars at home, but that's what I use on the show. I basically use those Tom Andersons and then whatever specialty things I need. But I basically have no more than six guitars up on the rack,
That's very reasonable.
Yeah, it's reasonable. Yeah, it's simple. And
those Andersons,
I've got a lot of acoustics. So the ones I mostly play these Taylor 514s. I've got two of them, and they're like a cedar top, with a mahogany. So they're very woody sounding, and they, they're not as, they're, I don't know. They're just solid. They tend to hold up with traveling, and they're all beat up and everything. At least one of them is pretty beat up, but it still plays and sounds good, and it works well for recording and for playing live. It's just a good go-to guitar. And I've got some vintage guitars too, like some old Martins and things, but I kind of use the Taylors more than that, just because they're really in tune and they hold up, and they're just like the Andersons, the Tom Anderson guitars. They just work, you pick them up and it works, and it's like, okay, don't need to mess with anything. It's good to go.
Do you deal with Tim over at Taylor?
Tim is, you know, back in the day there were, I think when I started with Taylor, it was about 2000 or 2001. So they
had been a long time.
Couple different artist relation people there now, but Tim is the guy. Now I've also been really good friends with people in the R&D department, you know, when they were working on their new pickup system, they would send me different preamps.
Oh, that, like the S2, I think it's called.
Yeah. ES2. Yeah. So while they were working on that, they would send me updates to the preamps, and they gave me some tools to put it in, you know, and so try it out, and then I would do some recording and I would give them my feedback, you know, and, you know, sort of help them out in that. And, but they're great folks. I like the folks at Taylor. There's a great company. People seem to really like working there. I mean, they got a nice energy at the company, you know, a really nice energy, and they've, you know, put out some great, great instruments, and that's cool. And made in America.
The Tom Andersons, he's got those steel frets, right?
Mine, I think he does on some guitars. I don't think mine has steel frets. I don't think they are, but I've never had a fret job done on even the 93. It's still,
wow.
It's got some wear, but it's not enough to really warrant a fret job.
That's pretty impressive. That's what, 26 years?
Yeah. And the thing is, I mean, I don't grip really hard with my left hand. I mean, I try and not exert too much pressure on the guitar. I try and let it kind of speak for itself and not like, you know, maybe that's why I try, you know, I'm kind of light handed on it. I mean, I can get a heavy sound, but you know, I used to use a lot of different things for my rig, but now I'm just using fractal axe effects because, you know, with Al, it's like you've got so many sounds you need to get, you know, and one tour can be completely different. And it's like the variety. I mean, I would need so many different amps and stuff, you know, to get what I get out of that thing, you know. So I've been using fractals for a while on the live show, and I have a couple of them. Well, one's a backup, you know.
Makes cartage Al a lot easier.
Oh yeah, I mean, I have one. I have a six space rack and a pedal board, and that's it. You know, yeah. I mean, it's very simple, and it works. You know, it works really well. It's just, you know, we use the in-ear monitors, you know, and so it just goes direct into the PA. Even though there's a Marshall cab on stage, that's kind of just for looks. You know,
a lot of people do that, man.
So it's just direct. It just goes directly out, you know. But I used to use a lot of before I had the fractals, I was using a lot of Mesa Boogie stuff.
Sure.
And I had a kind of a rack that had some Boogie preamps and a Marshall preamp and a power amp and a stereo speakers, and it sounded great. But you know, it's a lot of gear and a lot of maintenance, you know, to keep it all going.
It is, man. It's a lot of work.
A lot of, you know, one little wire gets unplugged somewhere from the switcher, and it's like, oh, what's going on? You know, and it's like right before showtime and you're trying to figure out this problem with your flashlight.
Yeah.
And with the fractals, it's kind of like, okay, just plug it in. It just goes, you know.
Totally get it, man.
Yeah. So, you know, I think for recording, it's one thing, but for live, it's like, it certainly sounds good enough for live. I mean,
someone's going to be in the studio and say, hey man, you need to have a tube amp for the music, for what you're playing. I mean,
for live, perfect. It's great. And I remember, you know, a couple of years ago seeing U2 they were on some performance on TV of some TV show. And I was just listening. I was like, man, the Edge sounds, man, his guitar sounds great. It was just like this clean, sort of slightly broken up clean sound. I was like, man, that sounds great. And then the camera panned over it. They showed his rack and it was like three fractals in there.
So yeah, the same thing you do.
He's using the same thing. Yeah, a lot of people are using them. Yeah. You know, Metallica switched over to him a number of years ago, and the tour manager was saying they saved like hundreds of thousands of dollars in shipping because they're not shipping all this heavy weight anymore.
Do you know Jennifer Batten?
I know who she is. Yeah, I don't know her.
I had her on the show a long time ago, and she was saying, you know, she travels all over the world and does these clinics and does gigs, mm-hmm. and you know, she's well known for all the sounds she gets. And I said, how do you do that? She has this amp. It's literally 3 pounds. She puts it in her purse.
That's great.
That's it. That's it. That's her rig, man. It's like, oh, wow, that's pretty cool, man.
You know? That is pretty cool. Yeah. You know, well, it's getting to that point, you know, the technology is getting smaller and smaller and, you know, totally. Why not, you know?
Hey, have you had, I don't know how Al's Gigs works. Do you ever have like guest players come up on stage with you from time to time or?
Not really. Not really. It's just, you know, on a tour like the one we're on now, it's pretty scripted out, you know, it's pretty, we have two different set lists, but it's very scripted because there's a lot of media and video playing and costume changes. And it's like a, you know, big production every so often. I mean, I think one time Al had Ben Folds up to play on something and, but it's very rare, you know, okay. Very rare, that ever happens. It's, I can only think of, you know, maybe one or two or three times in the entire career, you know, sure. These people up, but very rarely.
Talk about Desert Island Discs. What would be your top three just for now, just for like this moment?
Oh, well.
And are you torn? You have like dual musical pathways because you've got this whole slack key passion.
Yeah,
and
you've got
like everything you grew up with, probably.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, I always for Desert, you know, it's something about having, you know, the records that bring back memories. You know, I mean, records that just trigger these great memories. You know, and I'm thinking, you know, one of my first memories was hearing when I went to Hawaii was hearing the Gabby Pahinui record. They call it the Brown album. I forget. It's just the Gabby Pahinui band on Panini Records. And, you know, that was just so great. Rye Cooter was on that record, you know, because the producers had gotten in touch with Rye and Rye was really interested in working with Gabby. And so they put this record together. They recorded it, I think, on the Big Island at some house on the Big Island. They brought some gear in from LA and, you know, did it, you know, at this house. Anyways, a fantastic record. And that's just something that brings back a lot of memories. And then I also think of like, well, maybe the first record I ever bought was probably like Sgt. Pepper's by the Beatles, you know, I mean, well, you know, that's just classic record. And then, I always loved Steely Dan, you know, I mean, I used to listen to that Donald Fagen album, The Nightfly. That was a beautiful record, you know, beautiful, you know, just great mixture of such great, you know, compositions with such great recording, you know, it's just at the time, you know, because being in sort of from an engineering background, I was always really impressed when I'd hear a record that just had, a, you know, incredible recording quality. It was just like, you know, how did they do that? You know, and I remember
all of theirs was like that. Of their music.
And that, you know, that goes back a long time. When you think of the quality, I mean, even sound engineers now, I mean, some of those guys who, the front of house sound guys will play certain records to the system when they're testing out the system before the show. And they still use that record a lot, you know, cool. It's just a great sounding record, you know, but, yeah, anyway, those are the kind of things that, you know, records that sort of bring back memories, you know, that are nice, you know.
Nostalgia.
Nostalgic records,
I feel the same way. Best decision you ever made?
Well, I think the best decision was, I think I was 16 when I just said, music is what I want to do. Maybe 17, 16 or 17. It was like, I had this complete confidence that was exactly what I wanted to do and nothing else. And I luckily was able to, you know, come to that decision at an early age, you know, so I essentially have done nothing else my whole life. You know, I mean, I've had a few day jobs when I was young, but, you know, I've just pretty much done music my whole life. So
that's so cool. Did your brother play music as well ultimately, or
my older brother played the teacher, he just still to this day likes, you know, he plays and you know, goes to little open mics and just plays with friends, you know. Sure. He doesn't do it professionally, you know.
How much have you been, if at all, influenced by Hawaiian culture, and how has it impacted or changed you?
Well, you know, like you say, you know, when you went to Hawaii, you know, you could sort of feel that aloha spirit, you know,
people really feel it.
There's a really beautiful thing about that, about, you know, just meeting somebody for the first time and treating them like family, you know, like ohana. They say ohana. Everybody's family. And you know, that's probably the biggest impression that, you know, I've gotten from Hawaiian culture is just, you know, you try and take that lesson and, you know, and keep that with you, you know, and during your, you know, wherever you are in the world, you know, that's it's a really beautiful thing. A Hawaiian, you know, people are just beautiful people. And I think that also people say that all of Polynesia is like that. Polynesia, of course, Hawaiians are Polynesians. They came originally from Tahiti and the Marquesas and stuff and settled Hawaii. So they brought that with them, you know.
You know, it's interesting you say that. One of the things I enjoy most, and I have been, and I wasn't expecting that. It's something that I, you know, as I started doing this show, probably the thing I enjoy the most about talking to musicians is they're very open. They're very willing to share. There's no sense of, you know, let me be, I mean, look, everybody's got lines of what they're comfortable and not comfortable. I'm not talking about that, but overall they're very comfortable sharing. And, and that, what you, I was thinking about that, 'cause when you talked about that aloha spirit, that's the essence. Like, there's no like defensiveness. It's a very open, you know, hey man, how are you doing? And, you know, I would get the sense that if you sat and talked to someone and said, man, I'm struggling right now, that they would take a genuine interest and
absolutely
say, yeah, man, what's going on? How can I help you?
Yeah, you know? That's part of, you know, aloha is the, it's a broad concept, but, you know, it basically, you know, it entails, you know, just, you know, brotherly love, just like loving everybody the same and being compassionate and, you know, welcoming you. There's a whole tradition in Hawaiian music of, in Hawaiian lyrics, you know, about, you know, welcoming people, you know, welcoming visitors. And, you know, and, you know, it's funny because they don't, Hawaiians, there's no word for like foreigner, like in a negative way. It's always malihini, which means guest. You know, so you're.
Oh, that's really telling, man.
From another country is always a guest. You know, there's no like, you know, in, you know, foreigner or anything negative. It's always.
That is really like.
You're a guest, you know.
That's very telling about a culture.
Yeah, it is.
That's really freaking cool, man.
Yeah, it is.
Tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
That is a tough question. Well, you know, I'm a happy person. I mean, I'm super grateful, you know, for everything I've had in this life. And it's, I guess what I like is that I realize that, you know, I realize that, you know, how lucky I am and, you know, how, you know, every day I'm just grateful for everything I have. It's just incredible. It's hard to believe, you know, so.
That's nice, man.
I'm a lucky guy, and I think that's the fact that I realize it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get that. Flip side, if you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
Well, I'd be like, you know, buffed out, you know, muscular, and I could be like a freaking killer surfer.
I hear you. That's a good one, man. Killer surfer buffed out. Yeah. That's good, man. That's a good one. Most exciting experience you've had?
Oh, man.
Or happiest time in your life, either one of those.
Well, I think, you know, going to when I first went to Hawaii, you know, that was just magical. And it'd be pretty hard to beat that. I mean, that was, you know, first of all, being in this sort of remote, beautiful area of Hawaii with waterfalls and incredible natural beauty and just the discovery of it and the music. And I mean, it was just overwhelming, you know, I mean, just pretty hard to beat that. You know, I mean, if I had gone to Waikiki first or something, it'd be a lot different. But instead I went to a place where I was immediately kind of dumped into the deep end of Hawaiian culture, like going to local luau's, you know, the real thing, you know, the local parties.
Not on the hotel with 400 people.
No.
Bad rum cocktails.
These were like, you know, luau's that had like, you know, the black crabs and the squid luau and all the, you know, the real.
Dude, that sounds so cool.
Yeah, the real deal. And the old aunties in their long dresses, muumuus, with ukuleles, singing these beautiful songs, and just, you know, it's just magical. You know, that's probably I would have to say that's probably that was definitely a high point.
Is Hana still remote like that?
It is. You know, I mean, the fact that it's the road has been much improved. It was all full of potholes when I first went there, so you know, it was a really long, bouncy trip. And today you can do it in about 2 hours, even though it's only 45 miles.
It's still that windy, yeah. You know.
Well, you're going from sea level to 1,500 feet, and it's all steep canyon. So it's just switchbacking up and down, you know, the whole thing. The road is in great shape now. It's all, you know, like a fantastic compared to what it used to be. Mm. But you know, the fact that Hana is remote kind of keeps it. You know, there's a lot of tourism, but most people are coming in for the day and driving out the same day. You know?
Yeah, there's no staying there.
Yeah, I mean, you can stay there. There's definitely places to stay. Absolutely. There's actually a very fancy hotel there. It's a low-key place. It's been there forever, but there's a number of Airbnbs and stuff. You can definitely stay there. And whenever, people I know are going to go out there, I always recommend that they try and find somewhere to stay, because you don't really get to enjoy it if you're just seeing it driving in and driving out. Plus, that's a long day driving in.
I did? I'll never forget this. There's two things I remember on the way out there. I like to go to these local places to eat. And I remember on the way out there, it was like a little strip mall. And man, it was a tiny little place, probably like, you know, mom and dad's, you know, probably lived in the other side of it maybe, but it was like the best Mexican food I'd ever had in my life, man. It was on the road out there to get there. I don't know if that was called Hana Road, but it was on the road out there. And I just remember it was like, wow, this was like amazing food.
Well, there's a little in Nahiku, about half an hour before you get to Hana, there's a, you know, these, one of these little, this guy Skippy runs this place. That's a bunch of little kind of food places and a craft place and a place to get this. And, you know, it's like five or six businesses. It might've been that. I don't know. Because they have three or four different food places in there.
And then when we finally got to Hana, and I'm not like, I'm one of these guys, if I go on a ride I get stomach, I'm nauseous. So by the time I got up there, man, I was kind of nauseous from all that whining, right? Yeah. And I remember it was so nice. There were these women, it was like with picnic tables, and they were just selling fruit, like star fruit, fruit that I'd never seen before, right?
Yeah.
Star fruit and some other native. And it was just such a joy to just sit at the table with them. And it was like all of like a quarter for a fruit, you know, but it was like this simple little thing. And I'm eating this delicious fruit that was grown right up there, I'd imagine, you know,
yeah.
And it was just very, it was just nice, man. It was really simple. And I like that.
Well, there's a lot of those little, roadside stands nowadays, and, people sell what they have in their, you know, they'll have a yard right there with a lot of fruit trees, and they'll just put up a stand on the, and there's a lot of little stands that are the honor system where they just have the fruit and they have a little container and you put your money in there. It says,
right. We did that.
A bottle of, you know, 50 cents and you put, you know, you just, at the end of the day, they go and see what's in the box.
Yeah. I thought that was very cool. I thought that was really cool. It was really like, coming from the opposite, it was like an honor to participate in that, you know, like, wow, this is really cool that, you know, you're not in a store and someone's like, you know, making sure you're not shoplifting or something. And these guys are like, hey man, just take what you want. Just leave, you know, pay for it. You know, I thought it was really cool to participate in that, man. I got to ask you, your thumb, it looks like you're going to rip open a can of like beans with that nail, man. Is that yours or is that a fake nail on top of that?
I have acrylic nails. Yeah, they're acrylics. I always had trouble keeping my nails. I like to have a little bit of fingernail in my, and I just, you know, you break one nail and then all of a sudden, it's such a pain in the butt. And it's a friend of mine, another guitar player. He was going, Chemo, you got to use the acrylics, man. I tell you, they're great, you know. And I was like, nah, I'm not going to go to the beauty salon. You know?
A lot of guys.
One day he was like, Hemo, I got you a gift certificate for the beauty salon. We're going to go tomorrow. And, you know,
he dragged me
in there. Weird. You know, two guys sitting in the chairs, you know, and meanwhile, ladies are getting their pedicures and they're looking at us like, what are these, you know, what's up with these guys? I'm like, well, I just want them on these three fingers and my thumb and, you know, no glitter, no sparkles.
Well, that may be good for a Weird Al show.
Yeah. But anyway, I started using them and it was like, after a while, I was like, man, this is great. I mean, I love the tone. They don't break, and I'm, you know, it just, if you file them really, I have a file that kind of has four different grades of, from coarse to very, very fine. You get it down, filed down to where they're almost like glass, you know, and you get it really smooth, and then you get this just beautiful chimey tone, you know, and then the thumb, I've just never been able to use, you know, thumb picks and finger picks. They just always feel alien to me. So I have this long nail on my thumb, and what I can do is I can, you know, if I'm playing, I can play with a muted sound by using the side of my thumb on the bass strings, you know. But if I want to dig in a bit, I just sort of change my angle of the hand, and then I can dig in with that nail, you know, and I can get more of like a piano type sound, you know.
So you don't use a pick at all?
Well, not with slack key, no. Okay, with my electric playing, mostly with a pick, although there's always some things I play finger style, you know. In the show, this show, there's one tune I play sort of kind of a clean kind of Knopfler type style, you know, and that's finger style, you know, like a Knopfler sound, electrics, you know. But yeah, the acrylic nails have made a big difference. And I know a lot of flamenco players use them, and a lot of finger style players nowadays use acrylics, you know. A lot of the slack key guys, like Ledward and Kapana and stuff, a lot of them use a thumb pick. And like a Chet Atkins style or Merle Travis style, just their fingers and a thumb pick, you know, and they get that, which is nice because you get a really defined bass. I mean, the bass is really defined with a thumb pick, you know, but I can use them, but I'm just not that comfortable with them, you know.
I think if you start with something like, it's like writing left-handed or something, you know.
If you start doing it that way,
it's a lot easier than to switch that over. It's really tough.
Yeah, because all the Chet Atkins style players, that's what they do. They have the thumb pick and then just the regular fingernails, you know.
Yeah, I've met a lot of guys who do the acrylics. Do you know Pete Anderson?
I know who he is, yeah.
Yeah, he's like this sort of muscly guy, and his nail, all of him, I mean, he looks like a pterodactyl, like he could, like, I'm just like, and I was like, holy shit. And I think they're acrylics as well. We had a conversation.
Yeah. Dennis Kamakahi was one of the great slack key players. He's passed away a few years ago, but he had really long acrylic nails and they were all black. When I played my first slack key festival, you know, I didn't know any of these guys. I knew who they were, but Dennis came on stage, and this is on Maui, right? It's outdoors at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center, big, you know, it's probably 1500 people out there. And he's got like a long black leather trench coat on, a black hat, and he's got these black nails. And it's like, wow, who is this guy, man?
Not very Hawaiian.
No, but it was quite he definitely, you know, stood out amongst the crowd, you know, I mean, it's like, that was quite a look. And his nails, he liked them really long. I mean, they were quite long. I don't know how he played like that, but he sounded great.
Hey, three more questions. Anything you wish you'd done differently or anything you regret not doing?
Gee, that's tough. You know, I'm self-taught. I'm completely self-taught. I always say, well, I have a perfect record. No lessons or no music classes.
Hey man, but let me tell you something, but look at what you've accomplished. You've had massive success.
And also, you know, you learn a lot from playing with different musicians. You know, like some of my first bands were, everybody in the band was a music student or a composition student or something. And, you know, you pick up stuff from everybody, you know. In some ways I think, well, maybe I should have studied, you know, a little more formally. But I know at the time when I was in college, it was like, I don't want to, you know, be one of those cookie cutter, you know, students who are just, you know, are going to learn the same you know, stuff as everybody else. And I don't really want to just be a robot that sits there and plays, you know, charts. But of course, nowadays it's like, man, if I was a better reader, you know, that would be cool. I taught myself to read, and I can read, and I can, you know, write notation and stuff, but I'm not one of those readers who can just like,
no, but that's a special, there's like a few special guys that could sit down and read charts like that. That's like a really,
and that would, you know, I would love to be able to do that, you know, but otherwise I don't really have any real regrets. I'm really, you know, happy and grateful that, you know, for everything. So, but yeah.
Toughest decision you've had to make or most difficult thing you've had to do?
Well, I think, you know, you know, moving from Florida to LA was, even though I knew I had to do it, you know, it was difficult because, you know, I remember the day I'm saying goodbye to my parents, you know, and it's like, I've lived, you know, in the same town. I've never been away from them, really. I mean, I'd lived on my own, but I was in the same city and, you know, saw them all the time. And all of a sudden, you know, it was very kind of gut wrenching to be, waving goodbye, you know, and you're like off on a journey driving across the country and, you know, probably not going to be back that much anymore. You know, that was difficult, you know?
Yeah. I got to believe that. It's funny. We have three kids and we talk casually once in a while, like there's a big world and we can move, but I can't, you know, we can go away for a month or two, but same thing would be hard. We couldn't leave the kids.
Yeah.
It's tough to do that.
It was difficult. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, I knew I had to do it and it was exciting and I was excited, you know, to go to a place where there was a lot more happening, but at the same time, you know, it's like, it's pretty tough.
Yeah. I get that. Thank you, man. Yeah. And last question, Kimo, what's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years and how much of that has been intentional or deliberate and how much is just a natural part of aging?
Gee, that's a good question. Like I was saying, you know, my connection with Hawaii has really, you know, I've always been kind of a mellow person, but I think my connection with Hawaii is over the years has made me more compassionate, more, you know, just a little more aloha filled, you know, I think. I like to think anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure it has.
You know, I think, and I've also like as you do, as you get older, you tend to learn how to listen to yourself more, like listen to your body, listen to, you know, what it's telling you or what your, you know, what your physical body is telling you. Yeah, I think you get more in tune with that, you know, and I think that's natural. I think everybody probably has that, you know, as they get older, you know, I think you start being more in tune with yourself, you know, hopefully, you know.
Hopefully. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
It's tough enough when it's tough enough living when you are in tune. When you're not, it's going to be a hard road, man.
Yeah. So I don't know. I kind of feel, you know, I'm a pretty even keeled person. So I don't have a lot. You know,
just what you said, it just broke up right there. You said, I'm a pretty even keeled person. I don't have a lot.
I've known a lot of giant ups and downs, like emotionally and stuff. I'm kind of more of a steady kind of, you know, guy. And I think, and, but, you know, being my connection with Hawaii, I think it certainly made that more so, you know.
Yeah, that's nice.
And also, you know, kind of, you know, it's like you don't have, you know, that's more of like it's sort of a similar kind of a attitude. It's like, you know, it's not all about having gigantic highs and horrible lows and, you know, and really, it's more like you listen to your emotions, you know, you watch it, you know, it's like you observe it. I think that's what they say. You know, you observe your emotions. You don't become them, you know, you don't let yourself, even if you're super happy, you don't just go with that and become that. You just sort of observe that, you know, look at it and go, oh yeah, this is, I'm really down now, or I'm really happy now. But you look at it as an outside observer, and it keeps you from, you know, from being overly, from overly identifying with your emotions. And that sort of something I take, you know, take away from the sort of Buddhist philosophy.
I think that's good because you don't, I interviewed Phil Collins from Def Leppard and I asked him a question, like maybe what did he learn most about himself? And he said, I learned that don't ever think where you are now, the paraphrase, is where you're going to be. Because when you're on top of the world, I promise you something is going to kick your ass right off it. Yeah. And when you're sucking wind, something's going to come along and pick you back up. So I think that is a smart, and I try to do that to not, you know, to distance myself from, you know, where I'm quote at emotionally either way. So I could sort of like,
absolutely,
you know, I don't say maintain control. That's a funny word, but you know, I cannot become so invested that I'm like blind to, you
exactly.
know, yeah, I think that I like that too, man.
Yeah. I think that's what happens with a lot of folks. They get, you know, they get so, they identify so much with their, you know, emotions, like, you know, the way they say it in Tibetan, you know, Buddhism is, you know, emotions are like ripples on the ocean. They're waves, you know, they're things that are coming and going, but essentially the ocean is, you know, one big flat thing, but it's got all these ripples and you just kind of, you know, you observe that and you don't, you know, let any of that stuff freak you out too much. You just kind of go with it and go, oh yeah, this is what's happening now. And you just, you know, like I said, you distance yourself from it. And so,
well, that helps that you're, I'm like this too, that you're consistent. You know, if you're the, I always say, tell people, you can call me at 9 o'clock on a Thursday morning or Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's the same dude answering the phone. It's never like, you know, and I think it just, I like dealing with people like that because it's like, I don't have to adjust. Okay, which guy am I talking to? I hate that, man. It's just like, you know.
Luckily, you're not in. You don't have a show interviewing comedians. Because
well, I've heard that they're really like, a lot of them are really depressed or whatever. But
that's a whole different world. And
Well, Jim, let me tell people where to find you. First of all, thank you very much for everything. I really enjoyed talking to you. You're a super positive guy.
I'm grateful that our internet connection held up.
You know, yeah.
Thanks to the gods of the internet.
Thanks to the universe.
Keeping it going.
Yeah, man. You're in Iowa now, right? That's what you
said. Yeah, Cedar Rapids. We have a show tonight now.
There you go. Awesome. Hey, I want everybody to check out Jim's music. It's Jim Chemo West. First of all, you can check out his website. It's Jim Chemo West, Jim, J-I-M, Chemo, K-I-M-O, West.com. He's got a really robust website. He's got 12 solo records out there in addition to all his work he's done with Weird Al. His most recent album, it's called Moku Maluhia, M-A-L-U-H-I-A. Moku is M-O-K-U, and it means peaceful island. It's a really beautiful record, man. I mean, I just sat here and listened to it, and like, it was just like, oh my, I felt guilty. I'm sitting here behind a desk work. I mean, seriously, I felt like, man, I need to be laying down, at least have a cigar and like my eye, you know, seriously, it's a very beautiful record, man. And you got and you have on there, you have some flute, some fiddle. It was really nice. And it's a solo guitar. It's a really beautiful record, man. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much, Craig.
You're welcome. I mean that. And you could also check Jim out on Facebook and Instagram is at Jim Chemo West. And man, are you going to be tour? Do you tour Slack Key? Where would you post that?
Well, on my website will be in the fall. I'll be doing some shows with Ken Emerson. We'll be doing the Blue Note in Napa. Blue Note, which is the subsidiary of the Blue Note in New York.
Sure,
they have one in Napa. A few different shows with Ken. I'll also be playing at George Kahumoko's Slack Key show on Maui for 2 weeks in a row. Ken and I will be doing, they have it every Wednesday. It's like probably the godhead of ongoing Slack Key shows. So all the top players.
When is that? What month?
It's every Wednesday. So every Wednesday,
ongoing.
Yeah. It's been going for 12 years and, George Kahumoko is the host and he's a multiple Grammy winner. Amazing guy. Besides being a Slack Key player, he's a teacher and an author and a sculptor and a farmer and a fisherman and,
that's a typical Hawaiian thing, man, though, right?
Anyway, he hosts the show, and so Ken and I will be the featured artists last week of September, last Wednesday of September and the first Wednesday in October.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and that'll be up in Napili, Maui, beautiful on Napili Bay. It's just one of the most amazing locations. It's beautiful ocean there. So, and then next year I'll be doing the International Guitar Night Tour, and that's a it's the 20th anniversary of International Guitar Night. It's they always have four guitarists from different parts of the world, you know. And
when is that?
That is, it's you can look at International Guitar Night website, and they'll have the dates. It's basically January, February, and March, North America. And I'll be on tour with the other guitarists are Mike Dawes from England.
He's I had Mike on here. He's a great guy. You're going to, he's like 30 years old, maybe 31, but he's not. He's like 50. He's like an old soul.
I have not met him yet, but we've, you know, talked to him. And then,
super nice kid, man.
A guy named from Sweden, Oli Sokel. He's a jazz player, young jazz player.
Very good.
And then from Turkey is a Turkish guitarist, Cenk Erdogan, who plays the fretless nylon string. He's a very emotive, beautiful player. That's anyway, great. So we'll be doing, you know, solo. I'll be representing the Hawaii thing, and we'll be doing solo performances, and then the second half we do collaborations.
That's great. You're gonna like Mike. Tell him, mention that you came on the show. You guys have a good laugh together. He was really cool to have to talk to.
Yeah, we're gonna have a good time, and so we I think we start in Alaska, believe it or not.
Oh my god, talk about one extreme to the other, huh?
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. That's gonna be and then around Christmas time, I always do some holiday shows because I have two holiday slack key records.
That's great.
Some of my most, you know, popular records. And so in the LA area, usually, and sometimes in the Bay Area, San Francisco area, I'll do these holiday shows with, you know, we have a, you know, great hula dancers, and I mean, it's just like a whole show. You know?
That's cool. And where is that going to be posted, on your social media or on?
It'll be both social media and on my website.
That's great.
Holiday shows. I usually have at least two or three of them in the LA area, and they're nice because they're not like I say, they're big production for me anyway.
That's great, man. That's awesome. Maybe you have
pyrotechnics and no.
Maybe Weird Al can open for you.
Slack key with pyrotechnics would be pretty funny.
There you go, man. Why not, right? Kimo, thank you for everything, man. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, Craig.
Really
nice talking
with you. Very cool. Likewise, man. Thanks for taking the time.
You know, and next time I'm in Florida, man, we'll hook up and we'll go have some dinner and
dude,
stuff.
Please do. I would love that.
I try and make a trip there, even though, you know, I don't have any family much there anymore. I like to go back and see friends and then also play a few gigs.
I would love that, man. Let me know. Please hit me up. We'll definitely hang out. All right. Hang on. Let me just say goodbye to everybody. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it on your social media channels. We really appreciate your support. Check out Jim Kimo West's music. Go to jimkimowest.com and listen to his last album, Moku Malohia. It's beautiful, beautiful record, man. If you can't put that on and relax, you need to get meds. That's it, period. Make sure you get to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. Jim, thanks for everything.
Mahalo, shaka bra.
There you go, man. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.